I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Anti-evolution proponent William Jennings Bryan started the debate about teaching evolution in the classroom in Florida 90 years ago, and the debate shows no sign of dying down today.
We have, in Florida today, several organizations that still protest against the teaching of evolution.
Central Florida author Brandon Hort talks about his book, Going Ape, Florida's Battles Over Evolution in the Classroom. Also, mass transit in Central Florida is undergoing some profound changes with the arrival of the Sunrail commuter train and plans for an Orlando to Miami high-speed rail service. Adding to the mix of options is low-cost bus service, with Megabus expanding routes to Orlando. I'll speak with Megabus President Dale Moser about the changing shape of transportation. And later in the program, the Union of Concerned Scientists is releasing a report on the impact of climate change on historical sites. The report's co-author Adam Markham discusses substantial impacts climate change will make on Florida. All that ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Brandon Hort. Brandon is a founding board member of the Florida Citizens for Science and the author of Going Ape, Florida's Battles Over Evolution in the Classroom. I should note also that Brandon is the PIO for the Volusia County Sheriff's Office. Brandon, thank you very much for coming in.
No, thank you for having me.
Well, this is an interesting book. You're kind of delving into an issue which has popped up over the years, and you chart the history of this debate, evolution versus creationism, and it goes back a long way. And there are some sort of high points throughout that debate. I guess the most recent one you talk about is in 2008, but this is something that it seems that it's always going to be an issue at one point or another when you talk about education in Florida. And I guess that's probably what got you interested in the first place, as somebody who's interested in science education. Just tell me sort of what got you hooked on the subject and why you decided to write a book about it.
Well, I actually have a science education degree focusing in biology. I'm actually certified here in the state of Florida to teach biology, so I have, you know, that background behind me. I'm not just some, you know, some guy off the street to, you know, mess around with this subject. I took every single science course that was offered back in high school. I always had that interest in science. The reason why I didn't pursue it further than that was because back then I really sucked at math. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for much of science, you know, math is a strong component of that. And just, you know, went through life on a different career path, but then, you know, never lost that interest in science. Mm-hmm. And then once this subject of evolution and, you know, people protesting the teaching evolution would pop up in various headlines wherever I might be at the time, it really attracted my attention. And so I started getting a little bit more involved and a little bit more involved. And then around 2005, I joined with a group called Florida Citizens for Science. The mission of that group is to promote and defend strong science education here in Florida. We've done fundraising to get supplies into science teachers' classrooms. If they, you know, like in elementary schools, might say, "Hey, we'd love to have some microscopes for the kids to look at," mm-hmm. and we've been able to do some fundraising and provide that for them. We were strong advocates for, you know, the revision of the state science standards, which happened in 2007, 2008. We had a couple of members of our group who were actually on the writing committees, and you know, a wide variety backgrounds of these folks. They could be, you know, educators themselves. Some of them just, you know, retired folks. We can have some folks who are just concerned parents, mm-hmm. And you know, even some politicians. You know, just people getting involved, wanting to do something for science education here in Florida.
Does it seem to you, and as somebody who's a member of the Florida Citizens for Science, which has a pretty strong view about the idea of creationism versus evolution,
right.
Do you feel like, personally, that this idea that creationism would be taught in schools, is that a threat to good science education?
Well, I would challenge anybody who has an interest in this to go talk to the scientists. You have right here, just down the street, UCF, and go to their life sciences department. You can go to their website. You can give them a call. You can pay them a personal visit and talk to them. On staff, they have evolutionary biologists. That's their title. many of them in their own research pursuits have evolution as the backbone of whatever it is they're researching and looking into. Go to University of Florida, go to FSU, go to any college here in the state of Florida and talk to them. You can go to Gainesville and look at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Mm-hmm.
They have a whole hall of fossils that are devoted to this idea of evolution. This is an accepted idea in the scientific community. And we need to make sure that our students in the lower grades understand that and have just at least a basic grasp of the concept, even if maybe they're not going to go into a science career, but still to have that basic grasp of what's going on. It's very unfortunate that so many students don't have that. A colleague of mine sat down with a group of students in Polk County just last month. That was about a dozen students. They were high school seniors and a couple of college students. And he asked them point blank, what did you learn about evolution in your time here in the high school? And then he asked them some very just basic questions about their understanding of how evolution works and what it is. Not one single student in that group was able to answer any of his questions. Now, we can't really extrapolate from that to the entire state. That was just a dozen of students. Maybe if you went to some other county and talked to a dozen students there, they would know about evolution. But honestly, if you really did a whole survey of the state, I think they'd be very much like that dozen that my friend sat down with in Polk County, in which they'll be quite literally clueless when it comes to evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see the effect, any of them that go on to college, that they're expected to know it. It's a standard knowledge that they're supposed to know.
You say also in your book, though, that you don't really think this is a debate about science. It's more a debate about emotions than that. Just explain a bit about what you mean by that.
Well, any person that comes into this debate against the teaching of evolution, never, not once, have ever had a scientific argument against it. They have a very distorted funhouse mirror view version of what evolution is. When they say, hey, it's just a theory, that's just that one simple statement illustrates that they don't have a clue what they're talking about. The word theory has different meanings in the common usage, like you and I might use it. We have a theory on what horse is going to win the race or something like that. But in science, theory has a completely different meaning. It is something that's very solid, very well understood. A theory actually is, in the hierarchy, above facts. Theory explains how facts fit together, mm-hmm. like puzzle pieces and what's the bigger picture. You can then use that theory to make predictions. And if those predictions about, hey, I'm going to find a certain type of fossil in a certain area and it's going to have these certain characteristics, I predict I will find that. And you go out searching for it, and either you find it or you don't. That's the prediction. And when the predictions keep on coming true that, yes, hey, we did find this particular fossil exactly as we anticipated that we would, well, that kind of bolsters that theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not some random guess. And so as people come into the subject, arguing against it, they have quite literally no strong science arguments against it. It typically comes from a religious background. Not all religion. It's a narrow subset of religion that typically takes a very literal view of the Bible and what mm-hmm. it says. Many of these people believe that the earth is only thousands of years old versus billions. And they just really don't believe in the theory of evolution. And this propels them to want to argue against it and, try to somehow keep it out of the schools in some way.
Let me just go back to the start of the book. Now, you lay out how this all began. It began with William Jennings Bryan. He was he wanted to be president. He had a couple of cracks at it, didn't quite make it, and moved to Florida to retire ostensibly. But then, as you point out, he spent a lot of his time lecturing, talking about religious subjects and the like, and he was quite an important character in this kind of shaping the way the debate played out over the next century.
That is correct. This is back in the 1920s. This is when arguments against evolution were prominent across the country, not just here in Florida. But we had the distinct honor of having William Jennings Bryan as a resident here in Florida. He was an incredibly popular speaker, the golden orator, as he was referred to. And a lot of people sought him out to help with their own causes, whatever they might be. And so the people have sought him out to talk about the subject of evolution. Now, he was aware of it. He knew about it for several years, and he didn't like it, but he didn't really make a big deal out of it for several years until, as he's giving some other speeches, typically some like a Bible Sunday school type class, he would have people come up to him afterwards and tell him some shocking news. You know, we're sending our children off to college, and they're starting to lose faith. They're starting to lose faith in the Bible, and we're very concerned about that. Mr. Brian, what do you think? And so he started doing his own research, started reading and talking to folks, and he finally came to the conclusion that it was the teaching of evolution as fact in these institutes of higher learning that were turning these students away from their religion. And that's when he really started going after it. And when once he got hold of it, he wouldn't let go. He was a prominent figure in this fight.
Do you think the debate, the evolution versus creationism debate, would have gone the way it had there not been the influence of William Jennings Bryan? I'm just wondering if there are other people in that era who had the same views and came to the same conclusions about the fact or their perception that the teaching of evolution was corrupting the young minds of these people going off to college.
Yes, it certainly would have still happened. Maybe it would have taken a slightly different route, but it still definitely would have happened. Before Brian really got into it, just like a year or two before he really got into it, we already still had some stirrings here in Florida of... for instance, there was a coalition. I'm very sorry. I don't remember what the name of the coalition was, but there was a coalition mm-hmm. of churches in Miami, and they had regular meetings. And apparently they got a report from the local school board, and that local school board said, you know what, we don't teach evolution in our schools. And that was a positive report to this group. And then the Miami Herald got hold of that information and wrote a very scathing editorial about it, very, very sarcastic, saying that's, oh, well, you know, before you give this newspaper to your children, maybe you should cut out the parts about the earth being round. And every now and then we teach about evolution. We write about evolution, too. Maybe you should cut those parts out of our newspaper as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there was definitely this sentiment among the general public. And Brian was really just a kind of a very strong lightning rod kind of public figure that advocated that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think people are still as polarized now over this issue as they were back in the 1920s?
Absolutely. They certainly are. The very end of my book, I say that it's incredibly difficult to write a final chapter to a book when the story's not over. This book flows seamlessly into the present day. We have in Florida today several organizations that still protest against the teaching of evolution.
What do you think the future of teaching of this particular branch of science is in Florida?
It's just going to be more of the same. I think this history is going to keep on going and going. It's perpetual.
I've been speaking to Brandon Hort. He's a founding board member of the Florida Citizens for Science and the author of Going Ape, Florida's Battles Over Evolution in the Classroom. It's published by the University Press of Florida. Appreciate you taking the time to talk about your book.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was Central Florida author Brandon Hort talking about his book, Going Ape, Florida's Battles Over Evolution in the Classroom. Up next, a conversation with Megabus President and Chief Operating Officer Dale Moser. I'm joined in the studio by Dale Moser. He's the President and Chief Operating Officer of Megabus. Dale, thank you for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, of course, Megabus expanding the number of cities that it drives to out of Orlando. Just explain quickly what the expansion is and what cities are you going to be traveling to from here on out.
We started further service from Orlando to Miami, Tallahassee, Tampa, and then out of state to New Orleans with a stop in Mobile, Alabama.
So the business model, and you might just need to explain a little bit of the details here, but you provide pretty low-cost city-to-city service throughout the country. You advertise seats as low as $1 a trip. How does this work? How do you make a profit off of that?
That's a good question. Everybody asks that. We do express service. We use European touring double-decker buses that seat 81 people. That's unique to North America. All our pricing does start at $1 every day, every trip, every bus. So it's not just a promotional gimmick. But after the $1 seats are purchased, the prices start to gradually go up, very much like the, you know, the discount airlines have been doing for 30 years. Mm-hmm. We took that same concept and put it into ground transportation, inner city bus service. So even after all of the lower fare tickets are purchased, if you're trying to buy a ticket the day of service or the last seat, even that top price is still going to be more economical than if you were trying to fly or drive your car with the price of gas, tolls, wear and tear on your car and parking. Consumers tell us it's still more economical.
From your point of view, I mean, how much does it cost to run these buses? They're pretty new and modern. I imagine the gas mileage is pretty good for a bus, but still, as you say, you know, gas prices kind of fluctuate. They do tend to go up and down. So how do you kind of account for all of those fluctuations?
You know, we control our costs. Some of the things that we do with internet-priced sales, 99% of our sales are done over the internet. So that keeps an overhead out of the business. I don't need salespeople. I don't need ticket takers, things like that. And those cost savings we can then control and then pass along that savings to the consumer. It's all about yield management. So it's yielding the price, yielding the volume, spreading the volume across 7 days a week as opposed to 4 days are real popular and 2 days you're running, 3 days you're running, nobody on the bus. So we manage it that way, and that's how you can make money. And you keep your buses running. You don't send your buses from one country or, you know, one part of the country to the other. It's a hub and spoke kind of business model, and it works for us.
So when you say some days are more popular than other, do you charge more for those days?
You'll see that you'll get better deals on your Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday. Those are off-peak days for leisure travels, and that's what this is. This is a leisure travel service. Mm-hmm. Your peak days are Thursday afternoon, Friday. People want to get away for the weekend, come back Sunday, and maybe Monday. Those days, the demand is higher. You'll see a little bit higher pricing, but still, again, more affordable than the alternatives. But your best lower price days are going to be Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday.
Do you have direct competition here in Florida? Like, is there another bus service which offers something pretty similar, or are you looking at other kind of modes of transit that you're up against?
Yeah, you know, our true competitor is the car and maybe airplanes. That's where we get about 80-85% of our customers. So we're getting modal shift. We're getting a culture that's leaving their car at home, getting into public transit, and saving money, doing it reliably and safely.
Have you found that, obviously, we're still kind of climbing out of this recession pretty slowly? Is that when you found your service kind of took off? I mean, Megabus has been around for a couple of years, but did you find that while we're in the depths of the recession that people were turning to this kind of transit, you know, more frequently?
Yeah, there's a couple things that have helped boost our sales. One has been when gas prices have gone up, retail gas prices. For the very first time that I can recall, back in 2006, gas prices hit $3 a gallon. Love to see those again today. Now they've hit, you know, north of $4 at times. And it seems like certain thresholds get people out of their car quicker. Secondly, yes, the recession. People are looking to stretch their dollar. Whether they were becoming unemployed or worried about being unemployed, they're looking at how can I make my dollar go further? And they're looking at it from the standpoint of looking at alternatives. Megabus becomes a good alternative. It's affordable. At the end of their trip, they have more money than left in their pocket to spend on themselves.
Do you think there's any kind of stigma associated with low-cost mass transit?
There has been in the country for years, and we think we're trying to change that. New equipment, high-tech, Wi-Fi, internet-based, all the things that are really key focuses of what could have been that stigma. And we think we're changing. The whole industry has gone in an upswing over the last 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. In Orlando, where is the hub for Megabus? Where would you pick up the bus?
North Gertrude. So we're about a block and a half away from the Link station. So it's convenient, easy access to the highway right there. And then you can go to all those different cities.
Is the success of a service like this dependent on there being good forms of mass transit in their destination city too? You know, we've got the likes of Zipcar in some cities, other kind of car sharing opportunities, bicycle sharing even. Do you have to have something like that in the city you're traveling to encourage people to take something like Megabus or another form of mass transit?
You know, it's not necessary, but what we do find and what we like is other forms of intermodal connectivity. So if we come in and have a stop location at or close to other forms of rail, subway, bus systems, zip car, or easy access of walking within a few blocks to get to hotels, restaurants, theater. That all is exactly what customers are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
They no longer would need a car when they get to that city.
And let me ask you, too, I mean, the fact that you're expanding from Orlando at this point in time, why did you pick Orlando? Why does this seem like a good location to build out some of those routes?
Well, Orlando happens to be a really good destination city. And of our 14 hubs, you'll find most of them are destination cities: New York City, Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles. So the destination cities, and then we hub and spoke out to other large cities. And that's the clientele we're looking for. We're not looking to stop at 10 little towns along the way. That's not our business model. We just want the people who are looking to go from one major city to another and want to do it, you know, affordably, safely, and reliably.
I've been speaking to Dale Moser. He is the president and chief operating officer of Megabus. Megabus has just expanded in Orlando, traveling to some more cities throughout Florida. Dale, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
That was Megabus president and chief operating officer Dale Moser. Up next, Climate Impact Report co-author Adam Markham from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Joining me by phone is Adam Markham. He is the Director of Climate Impacts at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Adam, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, your Union of Concerned Scientists is releasing a report to Congress that details the impact of climate change on national landmarks. What are some of the standout findings from this?
Well, I think we've all been surprised as we pulled the research together how threatened historic sites and landmarks and national parks in the U.S. are. Climate change is really beginning to have an impact on places from the Statue of Liberty down to the Everglades National Park and some of the archaeological sites in Florida and Alaska. So, I mean, all around the country, we're seeing impacts and predicting much worse in the future.
Do you think the likes of talking about the impact on the Statue of Liberty, would people have been as aware of the potential threat to that from climate change pre-Superstorm Sandy, for example?
No, I don't think so, and probably the National Park Service wasn't as aware of it then either. Superstorm Sandy had a real impact in that it's coming on top of decades of sea level rise. And so while the storm itself may not have been caused by climate change, probably wasn't, the damage that it caused was exacerbated by the sea level rise. And that's going to happen all down the East Coast. As the seas rise, storm surges will be worse in the future.
And this may be a silly question, but is Florida kind of more in the crosshairs of this just because of the fact that it's such a low-lying state?
Yeah, Florida is kind of ground zero for sea level rise in the United States, partly also because of the underlying geology in southeast Florida. You can't just put up a seawall and prevent the sea coming because the limestone that underlies southeast Florida is porous, and so the water can come up from underneath as well as across from the shore. And so Florida has double the problem than any other state does, really.
Right. And of course, here in central Florida, where I'm calling from, Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral are sort of highlighted in the report of areas that are threatened. What are some of the specific concerns to that area of Florida?
Yeah, in central Florida, I think Cape Canaveral is kind of the poster child for impact because you have both these very important archaeological sites at the Cape Canaveral National Seashore, and then you have this incredible historic and still very important space center. And it's, they like to build rocket centers on the coast because when you launch the rockets, you kind of don't want pieces dropping off on inhabited areas. So doing it by the sea is an important thing. And NASA has many of its space center research centers on the coast, and Cape Canaveral is one of those, probably the most iconic of those. And it's really at risk from sea level rise, erosion, storms breaking through the dunes and flooding the wetlands. And so it's a big problem at Cape Canaveral.
What do you see happening in the scenario of maybe a location like Cape Canaveral? What could be done to protect that given the kind of tight budgets that government agencies like NASA are under?
Yeah, I think that a lot of government agencies, the Department of Defense, NASA, the National Park Service, are very aware of the problems, and they're putting money in their budgets, but they're limited by the amount of appropriations they can get from Congress. And I think Congress is going to have to take this issue a little bit more seriously, and there does need to be funds coming into not just federal agencies, but to communities. Most of the Florida communities threatened by sea level rise know some of the things they need to do, raising the roads, putting up seawalls, allowing wetlands to migrate, controlling coastal development in places where new houses shouldn't be built, but they don't have the federal resources to support that. And so we can't stick our heads in the sand much longer. We are going to have to dedicate national resources to becoming more resilient. And at the same time, we should do something to reduce the rate of climate change, and that means reducing greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels too.
Right. And you said before that sea level rises are happening quickly, but in putting that in context, I mean, when you say happening quickly, you're talking about sort of 5 years, 10 years, a matter of a year or two?
Well, we've already seen several inches of sea level rise on the Florida coast. Parts of the U.S. East Coast are being the sea level is rising three times faster than the global average. And we're looking at, across the East Coast, something like 2 to 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, and it's increasing every year. So the big rises are going to be a few decades away, but anybody who's planning for anything less than a foot and a half of rise by 2040 or 2050 is definitely not thinking the right way.
Are you up against, though, a little bit of short-term thinking when you have people saying things like, well, we're worried about putting too much resources into combating climate change or the effects of it because we're concerned about jobs and we're worried about policies that might threaten jobs in the near term? Is that a problem for scientists?
I think it certainly is a problem, short-term thinking. But we have been talking about climate change impacts for more than 25 years now, and so if we'd started doing something about it 25 years ago, it wouldn't be quite such short-term thinking now. But clearly, people have resource decisions to make. In Southeast Florida, there's a lot of discussion amongst the four counties in Southeast Florida. They have a very innovative program to try and get ready for climate change. And so I think that mayors and county commissioners throughout the country where they're being impacted are thinking about this as an immediate and short-term problem. I mean, they're beginning to think about flooding just in the same way they do about bridge and road maintenance. And so I think it's more in Washington that people have the blinders on than in the local communities where they have to deal with these issues already.
Right. So in summary, Adam, what are you hoping comes out of this report? What kind of reaction are you hoping for?
Well, I think we are hoping that people across the country will open their eyes to how large this problem is. And one thing President Obama has done is proposed a national resilience fund to bring federal resources to impacted communities. And I think something like that would be a great step in the right direction to support bringing federal resources to local places where the impacts are being felt already or will be in the next year or two.
I've been speaking to Adam Markham. He's the Director of Climate Impacts at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Adam, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me.
Great. Thanks very much.
That was Climate Impact Report co-author Adam Markham from the Union of Concerned Scientists. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.